And welcome to the final presentation in this, our 10th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague in the blue back there, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our website guru, Aiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Our technical specialist tonight is in the blue, Jason Hatman, who rescued us by racing back to the office and getting a screen tonight. Daniel Peach designed our posters. Our speaker tonight is one of Western's most traveled scholars. He set foot on every continent and dipped his body in every ocean. And still has plans for future trips, he tells me, to Russia, Africa, and South America. He once wrote that travel for me is not a love, but an obsession. He's a native of Niagara Falls, New York, where his family has lived all of his life. He grew up wanting to be a scientist and was influenced to study geography by some of his teachers. He attended the State University of New York at Buffalo before receiving his MA and PhD in physical geography and climatology from Indiana University in Bloomington. He taught at both Indiana University and Indiana State University before joining the faculty of WKU in 1980. At WKU, he's taught a variety of classes, served as director of the College Heights weather station, and even hosted a weather-related program on WKYU. He's conducted research projects leading to 70 articles and 90 presentations, and served as an expert witness for many court cases which involve weather conditions, ranging from traffic accidents to murders. He's even an expert on the Civil War and is a frequent participant in reenactments. He's taken on a new challenge recently as curator of the College Heights Weather Instrument Museum. He's co-author of two of the biggest selling textbooks in the field of geography, Essentials of Physical Geography, now in its 8th edition, and Physical Geography, now in its 9th edition, both published by Brooks Cole. He's also written on topics as diverse as Salt, Silver, and the Sundance Kid, adventures in the Bolivian Andes, tsunami devastation in Thailand, and tourism at the ozone hole. In addition to his publications and lectures, he's written and narrated educational television programs concerning weather and climate for KET and for WKYU-TV, Western Kentucky University Television. In his desire to explore our country's largest and most remote state, he first visited Alaska in 1991 and returned again for a visit in 2007. And it's a fitting time in this heat to talk about Alaska. Please welcome Michael Trepasnik.
Yeah, today we're going to end the series with this evening. So let's have some fun. We're going to look at some pictures and let's just have some fun with Alaska, the last frontier. At least that's what they put on their license plates. But there's a lot of truth to that. Alaska is one of those places where it's not that hard to go literally to the end of the line. Now, going to the end of the line, a nice literary phrase that you could use, but seriously, in that state, you can have interstate highways, you know, two lanes with a median in between, and then you get into state roads with one lane on each side, and then you get into roads that are, you know, more or less paved, and then you get into basically dirt roads that need a serious vehicle to drive, and then things come to an end. And when they come to an end, it's not at the end of, you know, on a seacoast or a city or a lake. No, it comes to an end, and you know there are hundreds of miles left to go that is literally unexplored. And that's a state that, you know, if you don't have access to fly, you'll never see the whole state. I mean, only, you know, if all you're doing is driving or taking a cruise ship, there are only certain places you can go, and there's only a certain amount you can see. So let's kind of play with that. Of course, every geographer, you start off with a map. You got to start off with a map because I'm a geographer. But still, it's always a good place to start. So first of all, if anyone has taken or is planning to take or thinking about taking an Alaskan cruise, you know, you'll come up. Usually the cruises take off from Seattle or Vancouver, British Columbia, come up the Canadian coast, and then you get into what is called the Inside Passage. And essentially you're exploring in through these particular locations. We'll visit all of these very briefly. And you're always very close to the coastline. There's something very important. Climatologically, there are some really vicious storms that exist in these latitudes. They're called subpolar lows, for my students who might remember that phrase from years ago. Subpolar lows, these are some of the most dangerous, vicious storms in the world. And so when a cruise ship is going, they are not going to go out to sea. They're going to hug the coast. And certainly as soon as they can, they're going to get into protected water, into some of these fjords and bays and be on the lee side of an island, of course, to keep away from those kinds of dangerous sailing conditions. And then most of them end up in Seward, and then from there either drive to Anchorage and fly out. And the 2007 trip, we took a cruise through this area because I had not seen this area before in my first trip. And then also taking a part of a land trip to go poke into pretty much the central part of Alaska, especially up at Fairbanks. I had missed Fairbanks in 91. But this area that we'll explore at the end up in the tundra, that goes back to my 1991 trip, because that was a couple of years after the Exxon Valdez accident, as I think most people remember. And I was very interested in that point in the oil production there on the tundra. Okay. Another thing I want to point out, this is kind of fun, you know, and if you get to Alaska, you'll see this. When people are talking, when an Alaskan is talking to you about some kind of geographical reference, they very often do this. And what they're trying to do is imitate the map. Okay? Here's the Inside Passage. There's the Aleutians. And, of course, the rest of it is... So people are always constantly doing this to you. And they'll say, okay, well, then they can tell you, okay, well, you're going from Anchorage to Fairbanks. Or you're going, you know, from Ketchikan to Juneau. Or you're going to Dead Horse. And they point to their hand. They literally make a little map out of their hand because it's such a huge area. Okay, well, let's move on. Okay, let's start off. We're going to start off down and south and work our way northward. Ketchikan, according to them, the salmon capital of the world. If you like salmon, and I do, I'm not a big on fish, but I do like salmon. And Alaska, of course, is paradise for that. There's just all these different varieties that are up there on a regular basis. Ketchikan, like many of these cities, especially in the Inside Passage, have developed because of tourism, because cruise ships will let thousands of people off. Now there's a reason to have a town. Prior to that, some of these places were nothing more than a mining camp or a small fishing port. Right? There wasn't much of anything in that part of Alaska. Once you get into, you actually start seeing this kind of Indian culture on the Pacific West Coast. In Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Canada, you get into the Indians who use totem poles. Now, that's a form of Indian expression and art and religious belief that we don't have down here in the Southeast. I mean, we're all, to some extent, a little bit familiar with, you know, the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Creek, the Seminoles, you know, some of the Southeastern Indians who don't use totem poles. I'm personally from Western New York. New York State has the Iroquois Nations. They don't use totem poles. You go out west, all of a sudden, totem poles appear. This is a lodge house. This is a reproduction of a lodge house from the Tlingit tribe. There are a lot of Indian tribes in Alaska. This is basically a side view. Again, it was meant to be kind of a community gathering place, a meeting place. It's not living quarters. Inside, again, it's a little bit dark. Of course, you've got the wood. There's an area in the middle of the floor. It would be roughly in this area, if we could extend the picture out, where fires were built. And then, of course, everyone sits around the fire and discusses whatever tribal business. This is a shot of Ketchikan from the deck of the ship. And the ship was, again, one of these monster cruise ships. I don't like cruise ships. I don't like cruises. But if you're going to get to that part of Alaska, you have to do it by ship or by plane. And you can see that Ketchikan is not a very big city. It extends a little bit off to the left of the screen, but not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. Because a lot of these are very city, small cities, and they're designed to handle the folks coming off the cruise ships. Juno, right? One of the few capitals. Well, they say it's the only capital of the United States that you can't drive to. You either got to fly there or take a ship. Yeah. Now, people can argue, well, the same of Honolulu. Well, the in Oahu, the island of Oahu, a lot of people can drive to their capital. There's not a whole lot of people around Juno. So seriously, if you've got state business and you got to go to the state capital, you either have to fly in or take a ship to go into the state capital. A very nondescript capital, looked like a business, just kind of like an office building, didn't have any domes or cupolas or some of the neat stuff. This was 2007, and what, Sarah Palin, she quit last year. So I guess she was governor at the time. She wasn't there.
She started in 2007.
She started in 2007. Okay, well, she wasn't there anyway, and which is fine with me. Close to Juno was the first up close and personal with some ice. This is Hubbard Glacier, which incidentally, is that still here? Yeah, it's on the cover of the book that is going to be whatever given out, raffled off later. This is Mendenhall Glacier. Glaciers, for anybody who knows me, and I've done a lot of traveling around the Arctic Circle and up into high altitude, and I love glaciers. I think they're just fascinating, dynamic even in their own way, as slow as they may be. Glacial ice is very blue. I think some of the blue color is a little bit washed out in all of this lighting. And as it comes forward, you occasionally have what is called calving, where a big chunk of ice will literally fall off the front and go splashing in very dramatically into the water in advance. That was kind of neat. We'll learn a few glacial landforms. Let me try to play the role of professor a little bit anyway. This is something called a kettle lake. Now imagine, as a glacier is retreating, a big chunk breaks off. And as it's retreating, some of the meltwater and the sediments from that meltwater will kind of wash around that busted off piece of ice. When that ice melts, what you have is a lake, a little lake. They're called kettles, little kettle lakes. They're not very big, but they're all over the place. And they're really quite pretty. A lot of them are. The opposite of that is something called a kame. And a kame is this nondescript pile of what looks like a pile of rocks and dirt in a, kind of a small hill. Again, imagine, as a glacier is retreating and melting away, sometimes glaciers will let out a big clump of stuff, right? Not just wash it out a little at a time and cover the ground with a veneer, but literally will flush out a big clump of stuff. And that's what this is. Kames and kettles, they tend to come in pairs. Kames are the little hills, kettles are the lakes. And icebergs, again, glacial ice is blue. The older the ice, the bluer it gets. And I can see it a little bit better on the screen. It washes out somewhat here. But there are some very distinctive shades of blue. As the ice gets older in the density, as it sits and squeezes it through the perhaps hundreds of years, thousands of years, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, squeezing, the air bubbles out, the ice loses its white color and starts to turn rather blue. Glacial striations, right? When glaciers move across a landscape, they scrape all kinds of scratches into the rock. This is always a dead giveaway that you're in a glacial area. What else would you have that could scratch across a piece of bedrock? When a glacier is moving, it incorporates material into its bottom, and it becomes an abrasive tool, essentially. Glaciers have the ability to cut into rock and to scour into rock. And glaciers are also incredible bulldozers. Whatever's in front of them, nothing's going to stand. Whatever's in front of them will be pushed like a gigantic bulldozer. So when you think of glaciers, think of a sculpting tool, a grinding tool and one heck of a bulldozer, and nothing stands in its way until climates change and it starts to retreat due to glacial melting. Moseying down the line, all right? Take some shots from the deck. One of the nice things about a cruise is that they're always close to shore. I told you why. One of the reasons was safety. And the other reason is you want people to see something. So you can see some really lovely landscapes as you're going along, just cruising along. Especially late in the day, you might have some wonderful, spectacular sunsets that may come along. Skagway. The first time I heard the word Skagway when I was a kid, I thought it was a made-up term. I said, surely there's no city. Somebody would actually call a city Skagway. Yeah, well, obviously there is one. This is a building, a Skagway like Ketchikan is one of these. They're waiting for the cruise ships to come out, and they got all the bars and the souvenir stores and all the fudge stores and all the candy stores and everything ready for tourists. This one is a fascinating building because these are all antlers. Now, the antlers are a facade. It's not the whole building is made out of the antlers, but it is a facade, and still unique. I've never seen a building quite like this. And again, you can see a little bit of, you know, what some of these towns are. And of course, all these people came off a ship. The Red Onion is like one of the famous bars in that area. So, you know, everybody in the cruise, you can see there's a line trying to get into this one place because the cruise director said, ooh, you got to go to this place. I didn't go to that place. When you have glaciers on mountaintops and you've got a mountainous area, you're going to have waterfalls, lots and lots of waterfalls. And this is just very typical on hiking trails that you take outside of town. You could hear it, and when you get close enough, you can actually smell it. Take it from me, I grew up near a falls. You can smell a falls. It's just a soothing feeling. Waterfalls are very relaxing and always a destination on a hiking trail. This is one of my favorite glacial features. This is something called a cirque, C-I-R-Q-U-E. It is a bowl-shaped depression, right? Notice you see, kind of a bowl-shaped depression. At one time, of course, it was filled with a glacier, and the glacier literally dug that bowl out, literally cut in and ground it out and made this rather large depression. It's called a cirque. Very common. Once I point some of these out to you, I hope you'll be able to spot them in some of the other pictures. Here we're close to the snow limit here. There's a cirque in the background. I know it's kind of too early to have you identify glacial features. These sharp peaks here are called horns. You may have heard that term. The largest horn in Switzerland is the Matterhorn, right? The mother horn. That's what it means. Horns are the sharp peaks that are left behind after glaciers have ground down all the sides. You get a bunch of horns in a line. This is a ridge line, right? This is called an arête. These are all French terms, incidentally. A-R-E-T-E with a funny little hat with the first E. And here what you've got are horn and then depression, horn, 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 horn. What I want to impress upon you is not only is this kind of a sawtooth edge, but if you were to fly over it, it is very thin. I mean, this is not a broad plateau. These mountains come up to a very sharp edge. So not only do you have sharp points, but you have a sharp edge running along the entire ridge. All right, here's another one, a different arête at a different area. Okay, again, horn, 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 horn. And you put them together in this sawtooth ridge called an arête. Now, in between the horn, we have these openings, little mountain passes. And that's called a col. I don't expect you to remember these names. I just want to tell you that these features actually have names. This one, I got kind of some hard feelings for, because the French, studying the Alps in France, were the first to name some of these features, like horns and cirques and arêtes and cols. Had the Italian scientists named some of these features, a mountain pass in Italian is called a trapasso. And I'm, yeah, that would, you know, for a guy who's a professor of physical geography to have his name in every textbook would have been so cool. But now the French—it's a coal, unfortunately. Coals are again the gaps in between the horns, right? And just sailing along with the breeze. Every once in a while, I just want to show you something pretty. And he's all taken off the deck of the ship. So again, there's a lot to be said for these cruises, despite the fact that I don't like cruises. This is one of the prettiest kettle lakes. This is near a place called Icy Strait. And this is a little kettle lake, but I like it because it's such a mirror image. It's my attempt at art. And it kind of worked. This is a little bit more like Icy Strait. There's supposed to be some really wonderful whale watching out here. There wasn't anything going on that day. But I didn't want to spend a lot of money to go out looking for whales because I've been to the Antarctic, and there you see you look a whale straight in the eye. So, I mean, it kind of spoils you for, you know, seeing some whale's tail out in the distance. I'm not going to pay a lot of money to see a whale when I've seen one almost as close as I am to you. But here, some good whale watching on certain days. This is Icy Strait Point. We're still in the inside passage. Hoonah is the closest town to Icy Strait, and rather than take a whale trip out on a boat thinking you might see a whale in some distance, I decided to take basically a road trip to go inland and see what else was there. And wildlife all over the place. In Alaska, I guess maybe because they're so endangered here in the United States, it is a haven for the bald eagle. I mean, if you're a bald eagle fan, I mean, you will see, I mean, dozens of them. There, you know, here's, well, believe it or not, there's four of them. There's one, you can't see them over there. Yeah, and they're in groupings. I mean, flying overhead. I mean, they're all over the place. Bald eagle, if you're a bald eagle fan, that's certainly a place to go, would be into Alaska. All right, we're going down the road, and there's a cop, and his lights are flashing. And we're in this vehicle, it's not much bigger than a van. And we stopped, and we're thinking, what is this? Now what? What's the problem? Now what? The problem was that there was a grizzly bear, and again, it was closer than that wall. I mean, there was the road, there was a little drainage ditch, and then there was the bear. And of course, the cops were flashing lights and doing sirens to tell people, do not come down this road. Now, the Alaskan brown bear, also known as the grizzly, of course, is a serious killer. It bluffs more than attacks, but still, if it decided to attack, that's it for you. And so we stood there for quite a while, and everybody's like shooting pictures out the window. Nobody dare step out of the vehicle. And so that was, again, a pleasure to get that close to bald eagles and that close to the grizzly bear, both on the same little road trip. Just for those who are environmentally conscious, this is, again, clear-cutting forestry, mining, and fishing. That's Alaska. Really, if you had to put it in a nutshell, what do those people do? It's one of those. And of course, nowadays, tourism certainly is picking up as well. Now here, I don't know if you can see this very well. This is a nice U-shaped valley, a hanging valley. Last week I was a judge in the Kentucky State Geography B. And one of the questions was that U-shaped valleys are indicative of what kind of process? And the answer, of course, was glaciers. And U-shaped valleys, I'll show you some valleys later, V-shaped valleys cut by rivers. But U-shaped valleys are ground out by glaciers. Another thing, and I don't want to get too scientific on you, but one thing that glacial ice does that water, liquid water, does not is that, you know, when you're, and I'm sure everybody's seen this, you see a tributary of a stream coming into the main trunk of a stream. They always join at the same level, right? Tributaries come in, join with the main stream, and go out together on the same level. Ice doesn't have to do this. At one point in time, there was a glacier that curved out this entire valley, and probably fjord, just carved it out. At that point, a glacier from the side came in and connected above. Now again, you've got the glaciers, main glaciers here, side glacier came in, do not connect at the same level. Ice does not have to do that. Water has to do that. Ice does not. So when both of these glaciers retreated, what you have is what we call a hanging valley. There's a valley. It's hanging considerably above the surface of the water. It doesn't connect as a river valley would. And of course, a lot of hanging valleys are give you some wonderful, wonderful waterfalls. Right? Just sailing along with the breeze. Every once in a while, I got to shoot something off the decks. It's a pretty landscape everywhere you go. I mean, you can shoot thousands of pictures, and you still want to shoot more because you think you're not going to see it anymore. And some nice shots from off the deck. Hubbard Glacier. This was one of my favorites. Hubbard Glacier is, again, you can see some of the features we've already talked about. You got your horns and arêtes. You got your glaciers coming in, feeding into the one that comes out to the ocean level. Now here was an attempt, and unfortunately a failed attempt. My digital camera I had at the time, which is not the one I have now, but the one I had at the time, would not allow to take a lot of pictures quickly. I needed a camera that could take pictures more quickly. What happened was a chunk of ice had calved off. It was dramatic. Splashed into the water. You can see some of the splashing. And I was trying to shoot some shots with it, and my camera wouldn't react as fast as I wanted to. So I would have liked to have had a time sequence of events of a big piece of ice calving off. Unfortunately, that was a failed attempt. But at least we got a piece of it, but it could have been better. Icebergs, some are big, some are small, some are clean, some are dirty. Then you land in Seward. Yeah, in Seward, there's nothing in Seward other than getting off the ship. At that point in time, some people would fly home, but we decided to extend into a land trip to head northward. On the way, there was a couple of places we could stop. One was actually kind of a zoo, if you want to call it that. It's really kind of a penned-in large area. And you can see that there are black bears in Alaska besides the grizzly. And, of course, there was the grizzly as well. Moose, lots of moose. Moose all over the place. If a grizzly charges, you're supposed to stand still. Because most time, yeah, I know it seems crazy, because most of the time it'll charge and then it'll stop. It's a bluff. And as he backs off, you better back off. A moose, if it charges, you better run. Because there's no bluffing with a moose. If it's coming at you, it's coming at you. Period. But I'm on the other side of a fence, so I'm okay. Elk, right? Lots of elk. And muskox. Muskox, not on the first trip, not on this trip, but in the first trip, I went to an area outside of Anchorage that was actually a muskox farm. Now, these are a big woolly creature. Maybe not quite as big as an American buffalo, American bison, but, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. They put these things in a box, right, so it won't get crazy. And believe it or not, and this seemed crazy until I saw it, they get some little guy to climb into the box and get kind of underneath its legs. And you're thinking, he's nuts. Well, yeah, I did too. And they're taking a comb, and they're combing some of its fur out and collecting it, combing the fur. And, you know, of course, he's trapped, so it's not, you can't really trample anything. He's kind of trapped. And this guy's just combing the fur out. You take that fur or hair and spin it into a wool, it is supposed to be like 12 times warmer than sheep's wool. I mean, it's supposed to be incredibly warm, never loses heat, incredibly soft, easy to work with, but because of the process, outrageously expensive. Certainly too rich for my blood. This is a wool animal. All right, you got some alpine meadows here. You got the mountains in the background and some animals. And again, so it's just like nice, serene areas. Now we're up in Anchorage. Okay, Anchorage is the biggest city in Alaska. About half of the population of Alaska lives in Anchorage. It is the city. Everything else is considerably smaller. And to give you, I meant to say this before, there are more people in Louisville and Jefferson County than there is in all of Alaska. And in Alaska is about, figured it out once, 12 times bigger than Kentucky, you know, area-wise, just outrageous. But Anchorage is the main city. Almost half or a little over half of the population lives in Anchorage. Anchorage, of course, is a place from a geography and geology standpoint, March of 1964. Some people claim it was the largest earthquake ever in the northern hemisphere, 4 to 5 minutes of shaking. I can't imagine that. Earthquakes, people tell me that in an earthquake, even a minute or two passes like an hour. I can't imagine 4.5 minutes of constant shaking. I'm sure people thought the world was coming to an end. And of course, that will always be one of the landmarks of gigantic earthquakes in this on Earth, period. And the tsunami that resulted, again, the epicenter was about 20 miles down, not too terribly far outside of, the focus was about 20 miles down. The epicenter was just a little bit outside of Anchorage. But you see the tsunami lines in how far it spread across the Pacific. Some of the tsunami waves that hit parts of the Aleutian Islands in coastal Canada, I say the waves exceeded 100 feet, some of them are approaching 200-foot waves. This incredible tsunami. In that area, we get into another Indian tribe. There's a lot of different Indians in Alaska, but this is the Inuits. The Inuits, this, for lack of a better term, I would call this an igloo. Now, when we think of igloos, we might think of, you know, seeing cartoons where some little Eskimo or something makes a little house, a little domed house out of ice and snow. Well, first of all, yes, they do. If they're on a hunting trip and they're out on the ice and they're going to be out there for a couple of weeks, yes, they do. They build an igloo, a domed structure out of chopping blocks of ice and snow and setting up a semicircular protective structure. But that's just temporary. When the fishing trip is over, they abandon it, it melts, no big deal. But the tribes themselves will make that same structure, but make them out of sod. They try to build a wood frame inside and then cover with sod. Still, semicircular, a dome shape. A dome, geometrically, incidentally, a dome gives you the least surface area, but by comparison, the greatest interior volume of any living space. More so than a box, more so than a triangle, more so than a conical shape. There is no geometric shape that gives you more interior volume with the smallest amount of exterior wall as a dome. Right, well, getting inside, I mean, this one is a recreation. It's at a kind of a museum park, and they have a number of these around. But it shows you how some of the Indian tribes actually set up their permanent structures. This is Talkeetna, a little mining town heading towards Denali, heading towards the national park there. And you can see that, well, not all of Alaska is all that pretty. This one here was kind of interesting. On the main street's one of the oldest bars in the territory, so that's all I needed to hear. And I wanted to go in and certainly belly up to the bar and have a couple of drinks with the boys. Heading from Talkeetna over to Denali, the national park, they have these train systems that kind of associate them with the, or they're connected to the tour, so to speak. And these trains have big, gigantic picture windows, and the glass also curves out on top of you as well, so you can look out the window and you can look up through glass as well. And so it's just a fascinating trip as you go along. As a matter of fact, across that bridge is over a very deep gorge and ravine. And you're moving along here. I want you to see the difference between valleys that are cut by water as opposed to valleys that are cut by ice. We'll look at that some more. Probably my highlight of the second trip was taking a side excursion, take a helicopter landing on a glacier. I'd seen so many glaciers face to face, climbed up on a couple, but I really wanted to fly up onto one and spend some time on a hike. And this was the helicopter. I think it was only four passengers and the pilot. And as we're flying along, you see some of the things we've talked about already, the Kettle Lakes, right, that dot the landscape. Here we go. Look at a V-shaped valley cut by water, right? Now, it doesn't look like the glacial valleys we saw before. This is inside a cirque. Remember the cirque, the bowl-shaped depression? And again, you got to imagine that you're flying into a bowl-shaped depression. And in the bottom, the water is starting to melt into a lake. When a cirque has a little lake in the bottom of it of meltwater, it's called a tarn. It takes on a completely different name. So here, right in here, this glacier is disappearing through time, and there will be eventually, of course it will grow larger, but there will be a lake right in the middle of this bowl-shaped depression. Right. And flying along, you can see that some of these glaciers are really taking quite a plunge. Pull of gravity, of course, is that which moves glaciers downhill, like it moves anything downhill. Here we go, another arête. Right. Now those knife-shaped or saw blade kind of ridges. Here's one edge on, right? Here's one edge on, and I know the lighting is still kind of bright despite the proxima. This is a very sharp, rich line, you know? This is, you know, even hiking on foot along an edge that sharp, you got to be careful. You got to be careful. Again, showing you how sharp the features are cut by glaciers. Another thing, dead giveaway of a glacial area is what we call a braided stream. As glaciers melt and their meltwater goes out and goes forward, it carries lots and lots of sediments. And these sediments are dropped into what you might call sandbars or little islands or little islets. I don't care what you call these things. But subsequently, the water has to braid its way to flow around. This is a dead giveaway. Anytime you see a braided stream channel, think glacier. Is you're in a glacial area, glacier meltwater. The other thing, and this is, this room does kind of highlight it a bit. Notice that the water is not blue. Water looks white, milky. Glacial meltwater is very milky. As glaciers grind those rocks down to a very fine powder, it's called rock flour. You know, like cooking flour. That rock flour suspends in the water and actually gives it a creamy white kind of appearance. I'll show you a more dramatic look at that a little bit later on. That's dead giveaway glaciers. All right, here we're up on the glacier. Yannert Glacier, not too far. We're still in pretty much the area of Denali National Park. We've landed. I'm out hiking. Here's a glacier coming in, and this is material called a terminal moraine. This is material that's been bulldozed ahead of the glacier. Right? It's a big, long pile of material being bulldozed forward by this glacier. And I'm standing on the main glacier here. So you can kind of get a look at the fact that glaciers, as they start to melt, they're not that pretty. They do get pretty dirty. Sediments do eventually come up to the top of the surface as the ice melts down. And there's crevasses, okay, cracks in the ice where meltwater is flowing.
Where were you standing?
On the edge. But some dirt. You know, there was something, I wasn't on ice, I was on a pile of sediment, so I had a good firm grip. However, this next shot, you could actually climb into it. Now again, here's my pointer. Here's the top of the glacier. I'm inside the crevasse. And here's the meltwater. So the meltwater started on top and slowly melted its way down to this level. But because you've got these deposits of sediments, what we call glacial till or glacial sediments, you're not on ice. You're not going to slip and fall. You know, it's like walking on dirt. But you got to be careful because I was climbing halfway down. I got a couple of shots, and again, the lighting washes it out. The blue color actually gives it quite an appearance. I've got one hanging, I got this picture or something similar hanging in my house in an attempt at art. Okay. Again, some of the glaciers, when they melt down, they're not as pristine and cute as you'd think. Mm-hmm. boreal forests, the great boreal forests, the gigantic forests of Alaska and Canada and into Russia, basically conifers, evergreen type forests, and again, miles and miles and miles of that. You do go, as you go up into highland country, you know, the trees start to give out, then we get into bushes, and then we get into kind of tundra grasses, and then we get into bare rock. Vegetation changes, of course, as you go higher and higher in elevation. These are all things that I teach in my classes, so I took pictures because this is the kind of stuff I talk about anyway. I'm forcing some of it on you. Here again, graded stream. You can see some of the milky water. Here, I know it's kind of hard to make out, but this is a semicircular, kind of a lunette-shaped pile of dirt. That is terminal moraine. In other words, the glacier came down, bulldozed this material here. That's as far as it went, and then it backed away. Anytime you have a terminal moraine, this kind of like a semicircular pile of material, you know that this is the extent at which the glacier advanced. From there, it only retreated. This, I shot this outcrop just because it was so cool looking. I got nothing to say about it. I was driving along and said, wow, that's cool. And I shot it. Weather stations, anybody who knows me, has seen any of my other trips, I always throw a weather station in there. What can I say? This is University of Alaska Fairbanks. So now we're in Fairbanks, kind of in the central part of the state. And fascinating school. There's some good people. Went to their geoscience department and hung out with some colleagues for a while. It was fun. All right, get this. Now, this is a river not too terribly far from Fairbanks. Look at this water here. That's glacial meltwater, that milky water that I was talking about earlier. Then you got this dark water in through here. This comes out of the forested areas. As forest pine cones and leaves, needles, and forest litter starts to decay, it becomes what we call tannic acid. It becomes a dark acid, gets into the water, making the water very dark. Dark water is very common also in rainforests, if you ever have an opportunity to visit a rainforest. Rainforest rivers are very often what they say in Latin America, agua negra, black water. Black water. This is forest water mixing into a tributary with glacial water, and to see the contrast, yeah, I thought it was remarkable. You know, like I said, you're going to get some geography crammed down your throat whether you want it or not. Okay. The Alaskan Range, of the three ranges, you got the Chugach in the south, you got the Alaskan Range in the middle, and then you've got the Brooks Range in northern Alaska. The Alaskan Range is the most dramatic. They were flying along. This is a commercial flight. I'm not. The helicopter's gone now. We're on a commercial flight again. And I point out a few things, right? There's a good big gigantic cirque. I'm heading towards something I was trying to see this whole trip and had trouble trying to see, and that was Denali itself, also known as Mount McKinley, the tallest peak in North America. Gigantic mountains have the tendency to create their own weather. And for days on end, all you could see was a cloud where that mountain peak was supposed to be, and it was driving me crazy. Yeah. Because I wanted to take a picture of the tallest peak in the North American continent. Finally, as we're flying along, sun cleared up, there it is, shooting out an airplane window. There you go. That is the tallest point in North America. We'll call Mount McKinley, 20,300 feet above sea level, but also known as Denali, which is the term that the Alaskans prefer. That's another shot that, again, you know, you're flying in an airplane, so I kind of lost the peak, but I got a little bit more of the rest of the rest of it, but unfortunately, I cut off on the top there. That was a major goal. I had to see that. I needed a picture of that. Very seriously. Flying along, you see some weird things. Saw this glacier take almost a right angle turn. That was cool. Don't see that very often. But everything else, I mean, the things I pointed out to you, okay? Here's the rats and horns and coals and cirques, all that sculpted ice, all that sculpted landscapes by ice. is flying away. This gives you the Brooks Range at a distance. You can see it was kind of a hazy day, except up front. And there you can see Denali in reference to the surrounding area. All right, the last place we're going to go is way up north, way up north. And this is the northern coast of Alaska, Point Barrow, the furthest north the American continent, North American continent reaches. This is incidentally a satellite image, and it's near infrared. Now you're looking saying, well, why does it look red? Because near infrared doesn't have a color. You know, it's not in the visible range. It's not what your eyes can see. It's a type of energy your eyes can't see, but we can use it to make images. So since near infrared doesn't have a color, we assign it a false color. And the false color for red here is green. In other words, if you were in a space capsule looking down on Earth, this would be the green. This would be not forest, but tundra. The gray is basically bare soil in mountainous areas, rock, and of course water. In near infrared, water appears very black. Destination, Prudhoe Bay. Flying over, you see something that's really bizarre for us, but when you get into Arctic areas, it's a very common thing. It's called patterned ground. These are called frost polygons. You've got this landscape that freezes and thaws and freezes and thaws over and over and over again, many times each year, through the years, through the decades, through the centuries, through the millennia. You literally form these polygon structures on the surface. And they come in a lot of different shapes. Here you got a nice little pentagon. Here you got a little box. These are called frost polygons or patterned ground. Flying in for a landing, you see some little canes and kettles. Okay. Here we go. Everybody knows what this is by now. It's a braided stream channel, dead giveaway of glacial contact. Talk about the end of the line. Have we got time for it? We don't have much time. Quick story. This is the Beaufort Sea. This is the Arctic Ocean. Pulling up, I was able to somehow get on a little manufactured little tour. And these two people conducting the tour said, "Is anybody interested in being a polar bear?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I would be, but I don't have a bathing suit." I said, "Oh, no, we got them. You know, you need two witnesses. You got to jump in, you need two witnesses. If you do that, you can be a polar bear." I said, "Okay, all right. So they gave me these trunks. I put on these trunks, went into 39-degree water, jumped in and swam a couple of times underneath, popped up, gasped for air because of the temperature. I couldn't breathe for a couple of seconds, but then I got my air back. And I'm now a polar bear, an Arctic Ocean polar bear. And it occurred right here in this spot. Literally, the end of the line. Here are some of these frost polygons up close. Now here you can't see it too well, but this you see it's more green around these polygonal shapes. Okay. You can see some of the cracks in these polygons. I'll move quickly because I know we need to be done in a couple minutes. Okay. When water freezes, it expands. So when you get underneath an Arctic soil, that water as it expands tears the ground apart. So you have a lot of tearing in what's called frost wedging that occurs. There are all kinds of weird things. Some of the clay from beneath will sometimes come up. This is a structure called a pingo. Now when the water beneath is frozen in the wintertime, you've got a nice little hill. But this is summertime. The water's melted and the hill collapses because of the structure, the ice underneath is gone. Okay. And some of these nice ponds and such. Remarkably clean because we're out in the middle of the oil fields, incidentally. And I've mentioned this in other trips that I've taken into Arctic and Antarctic regions. I'm amazed at the tiny, delicate flowers that you find in some of the roughest areas of the world. These are tiny, tiny little flowers. They're just all over the place. And again, you think, well, the oil industry must be filthing and dirtying and poisoning everything. Well, maybe not necessarily. They got ducks and various other, I'm not sure what that is. It looks kind of like a puffin, but I don't know my birds as well. Caribou, all over the place. I'm looking out at the hotel, if you want to call that place I stayed, a hotel. And this is very common now. Caribou have the right of way. One thing I will say for the oil industry, if an oil employee is caught walking on the tundra, you're fired. If you mess with a caribou, you're fired. If you mess with any wild animal at all, you're fired. If you drop any garbage anywhere on the tundra or anywhere on the oil field, you're fired. No questions. You're fired. And since you make a hell of a lot of money working for these people, you don't want to get fired. So it's cleaner than you would think. And again, caribou all over the place. This family, I walked with them for a while, and then they got sick of me. The airport at Dead Horse, that in itself is amazing, an airport called Dead Horse. There's Doppler radar and little small airplanes bringing myself and workers. Mainly, essentially, this airport, this area is just for the oil industry. Workers come in, workers go home. I got there, they didn't know what to do with me. You know, so I said, well, give me a room and let me buy some food and leave me alone. And we did. It's BP, British Petroleum, their complex. You got to understand now, of course, this is summertime, so everything looks so nice. But in wintertime, this is a city. This is a city. There's a large dormitories, you got a big garden, you got swimming pools, gymnasiums, of course, all your offices. It's like an enclosed city.
Why is it up on the...
Okay, because of the permafrost, the ground is frozen in the winter and thaws in the summer, and you cannot put a building in a foundation that's going to be part-time frozen, part-time mushy. So what they do is they dig into hit permafrost ground, frozen ground, and they might have to go, maybe 100 meters before they really hit good solid ice, and then they put the buildings on those. Who asked that question? Well, whoever asked the question. Well, whatever. That's why it is. Because the ground could be squishy and soft, you know, all the vehicles have very wide tires, right? Spread the weight out on a lot of surface area. Otherwise, real thin tires, you're going to get bogged down in the tundra real quick. You can get your foot stuck walking in the tundra. So can you imagine a big, gigantic vehicle? One of my pride and joy, that's mile marker zero. The Alaskan pipeline, as it pops out of the ground, mile marker zero. From there it starts 800 miles to Valdez. It's about 4 foot in diameter. 800 miles. About half of it is above ground like this, and about half of it is down into bedrock. One of the greatest engineering achievements of modern times, some people say. That's a pig. You shoot a pig down the line every once in a while, clear it out. It's like a ramrod. They have dumb pigs, like this one, and they've got smart pigs that have little sensors. And as they're shooting down the line, they actually send some data back to the sewer monitoring the line. Land of the Midnight Sun, okay, this is 10 o'clock in the morning. That's 2 o'clock in the morning. Sun never went down. Okay, I know we're running out of time. It's 8 o'clock, but it's just a couple minutes. Valdez, right? Now we're back to southern Alaska. Port of Valdez, and this is where the ships, that's where the pipeline loads the ships, and you can see all the storage tanks and all of that. This is from Prince William Sound. It was out here that idiot bashed the Exxon Valdez into the side of one of these islands and spilled all the oil, as you may recall from the drastic news stories. Little mining towns, you'll find those a lot. Those are kind of fun. I meant to have a couple more of these, but I thought I'd throw one in before we were done. A porpoise, you know, when you go out to sea, you're coming home, a lot of time porpoises welcome you in. Sweet little guys, welcome you in. So as the sun sets into the west, the Arctic west, and let us say goodbye to our intrepid geographer. Obviously, I didn't take this picture. This picture is taken by my friend and travel companion, Carolyn Moore, who always says, nobody ever gives me credit for my pictures. Obviously, here she caught me, geographer on the job. Well, listen, I hope you had some fun. I hope you learned a few things, and I thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you.
Questions? We have time for some questions.
At some time.
Right here.
Right.
Did he ever have any trouble with the pipeline, with that freeze-thaw cycle?
No, because, again, those supports, they're jammed into permafrost. Now, again, had they, and I'm sure they probably did some trial and error, at the beginning, if they just stuck them into the ground, oh yeah, the whole thing would wobble and topple over and spill and do all kinds of terrible things. But once they learn the fact that when you're working with ground that can be frozen at night and thawed during the day, the concept of frozen mud, think about that for a second. Frozen mud. When is it frozen? When is it mud? Yeah, they learn you got to anchor everything. Yeah.
Is there oil heated?
I'm sorry?
Is there oil heated?
Actually, it is. There is some degree of heat. I don't recall how much it is, but when it comes out of the ground, it's fairly warm. And, of course, the pipes, I didn't mention, are 4 feet in diameter, and a lot of that is insulation. If nothing else, just to keep it at a temperature where it will flow. Right? You don't want it to get too cold so that it starts to get sluggish. So
again,
keep it flowing. And like I said, every once in a while they got to blow a pig through just to make sure, again, it's a ramrod, just make sure things are flowing.
There was a question in the back.
When are you going back?
When am I going back to Alaska? Well, actually, you know, I'll tell you, the only place I haven't, well, I shouldn't say that. Alaska's so huge, there's tremendous amounts of area I haven't seen. But I'd like to get out to the Aleutians, right? That string of islands going on. Of course, that's dangerous. I mean, you know.
Volcano and everything else?
Well, you've got volcanic activity, you got earthquake activity, but storm activity would scare the heck out of me, I'll be honest with you.
Go crab fishing.
Well, yeah, no, isn't that where they do that crab fishing show was out there? Dutch Harbor and some of those? Yeah, yeah, that's serious. That's serious stuff out there. Serious weather out there.
Back in the back, in the green?
No.
Joe?
How much space was there inside of those Inuit mud igloos?
Well, there were various sizes. There were various sizes, but the second one I showed had two of them, like, next to each other. We had the main one that we went in, which was, could certainly encompass this entire group. Oh, yeah, very easily. Could have taught this entire space, including me, in the podium. And then the smaller ones, some subunit of that. Yeah, Peggy.
Maintain safety when the wildlife has priority over the whole world up there.
Well, you mean up? Yeah. Well, I think some. First of all, there's enough room for everybody. Number one.
And what do you do if you take care of the caribou?
Well, no, I'm not worried about caribou because actually, a caribou. Do you know the difference between a caribou and a reindeer? There is none. Reindeer is trained, and a caribou is wild. But it's neither here nor there. They try to get to your question. They are more afraid of you. So if there's a bunch of oil guys and they're working on a rig or something, no, nobody's going to bother them. The issue is always, are you going to leave the job and go out and mess with them, which is totally taboo. And so, again, the caribou, even on their migratory runs, they keep distant. They keep distant from human activity. Well, yeah, a family just kind of wandering around, which was fun because, I wandered with them. But it's like deer. Would you be afraid of a deer? Well, if you got crazy, I suppose. But no, they see you coming, they keep their distance. Yeah.
Well, on behalf of WKU Libraries and our sponsor, the Friends Organization, I want to thank you for coming. I want to remind you that tomorrow, one of the biggest events of the year in Bowling Green, the Kentucky Writers Conference, is at the Nicely Center up by South Campus, starting at 9 o'clock. So we welcome your budding author and always wanted to write. That's the place for you, and we'll be having sessions most of the day. And then our big event of the year in Bowling Green, of course, the Southern Kentucky Book Fest, which this year has moved from the Convention Center out to the Nicely Center and begins at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. And we hope you'll join us next year when we begin another series of faraway places with strange-sounding names. Thanks and good evening.
Thank you.